Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who, I guess, what people who would like to be out in the outdoors, and maybe fairly soon it feels like we are sort of getting there now. Although there's sort of restrictions on various areas, and it still feels a little bit uncertain. My guest today is back by popular demand. I asked on Twitter who people would like me to talk to, and the name of my guest came up more than once. So here he is. He is an expert on lightweight backpacking, has written extensively for outdoor magazines, and is generally, I would have to say, an authority on long-distance walking and lots of other aspects of the outdoors. So I'm pleased to welcome Alex Ruddy. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Hi, John. Not too bad. Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. Tell what went out. I think last time we spoke, you just published that huge tome, Wanderlust Europe. Is that right? And I think, and so I just wondered, what have you been doing since then?
Yeah, so Wanderlust Europe came out late last year, and yeah, it's been received quite well. I believe it's been translated into several languages now. So since then, I've been working on another project with the same publisher, so a similar kind of project, really. So like collating a lot of routes from various far-flung parts of the world and turning them into a book. I can't share too much about that one yet, but, watch this space. There'll be more about it very soon. And that's been taking up a huge amount of my time. I've also been editing the latest issue of Sidetrack magazine, which has been fantastic, really, editing these amazing stories of adventure from around the world. And we're putting that to print at the end of this week. And I guess the main thing really is my Kate Rathtrail book, The Farthest Shore, is now progressing through the publication pipeline with Vertebrate Publishing. We've recently finalized a cover design, and it will be out in early September 2021.
Right. Tell us a bit about that book. Presumably your input to it has finished now. You've done your bit and you've passed it on to the tender mercies of Vertebrate. Is that where we are?
Yeah, that's correct. So after I sent in the first draft, my editor looked through it, and she sent back a revised draft with a few requested additions, and then they've been taking it from there. And the cover design process recently has been the kind of last real bit with requiring my input. They worked with an artist to create this amazing illustration depicting Sandwood Bay, and the original idea behind the cover design is it was going to be based on a photograph, but I felt that the illustration style was a bit more contemporary. So it was a bit of kind of back and forth between the people on the publishing team and myself. And I think we came to a really good design in the end. And Vertebrate Publishing, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, when they're finalizing cover designs, they tend to put two or three options out on social media and say, which ones do you think is best? And I'm glad to say that the version that I preferred won. So
it's always good, isn't it? Before we go on and talk about the cover a bit more, tell us, for those listeners who don't know what the book's about, and indeed I know it's about your journey up the Cape Wrath Trail, but there'll be some people who don't even know what the Cape Wrath Trail is. So maybe you could tell us, just describe that trail to us and tell us what it was all about, what it was like.
Sure. So Cape Wrath Trail is a route. The standard route is between Fort William and in the West Highlands of Scotland and Cape Wrath, which is the northwesternmost point. Standard routes, give or take 250 miles. And I've done it twice now. And the second time I took a slightly different route, starting at Ardnamurchan Point, pretty much the westernmost point. So it was kind of lighthouse to lighthouse walk. westernmost to northwesternmost point of Scotland, and I did that in February 2019, supposed to be a winter trail really, but I didn't really get winter conditions to be honest, except for a bit near the start. The book is the story of this journey, and it's the story of what I hope to discover about myself, because one of the purposes of this journey was to kind of seek this extended period of solitude and disconnection from the internet, because I was going through a bit of a kind of stressful time, and I wanted to know how much that stress was being caused by my the way that I use technology, the way that I use the internet. So basically, I put my phone.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about that, a bit more. I mean, the Cape Wrath Trail is perhaps slightly different from many other trails in that, as far as I understand it, there's certain points you've got to hit, but actually how you get there is kind of up to you. And it's also the case that I guess it's fair to say also that the Cape Wrath Trail is the most demanding, particularly in winter, is the most demanding of all the long distance routes in Britain, and that it passes through some of the most rugged and sort of unforgiving terrain, really. And certainly in winter, it can also be passes through some of the worst weather that you can get in the British Isles. Is that fair, do you think?
Oh yeah, I'd say that's correct. I'd say it's probably the most challenging of the established long distance trails. Of course, you can go and do your own thing and do whatever you like. But and you're right that there's really no one established route. There's countless different variations, and you can string them together to make your own path. And indeed, many people do. And the official Cape Wrath guidebook from Cicerone Press, written by Ian Harper, which I found very good. It lists a number of those variants, and a number of those variants are also shown on the Harvey's Cape Wrath Trail map. So it's a really good route if you do like kind of finding your own trail and making it up as you go along to an extent, but still with the knowledge that other people have gone there before and that there is a possible way forward. So it's almost like a good halfway house between a signposted trail and just striking off by yourself into the wild.
Yeah, it certainly is, and it passes through some wild places. I mean, I was up in Sutherland only 10 days ago, really. And I didn't pop in. I went and had a look at Strathan Bothy, and I think that's a very remote wild place. But it perhaps gets more traffic now than it ever did before because of the Cape Wrath Trail.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, the trail does pass through some very, very wild locations, such as through Torridon round the back of Ben A, which is one of my favourite stretches.
Yeah, I know it.
through Ascent as well, which is wonderful. The entire area near, I'm going to mispronounce this, but Izakul Alwin.
That's a pretty good try. Yeah, you definitely got that wrong, but we'll forgive you that, since it's pretty.
That whole area is absolutely wonderful, down to kind of Glencal Bothy and Glendu Bothy. In fact, it very much is a walk of Bothies, you know, stringing together many of the best Bothies in the land.
Well, it passes most of the sort of Cape Wrath Trail Central passes through Mulbooey Bothy, doesn't it?
Oh yes, yeah, indeed.
And I met a long time ago.
that's right. Yeah, first Cape Wrath Trail back in 2015. Yeah, you brought in a delicious meal of bolognese, as I recall, which is
that's right. So I was just showing you how it's supposed to be done, you see.
Yes.
Anybody can be uncomfortable and starve to death, but you see, you've got to do it in style to do it properly, really. But now, what you were saying interested me, though, about it's possible these days to be in a remote place, yet to be totally connected to to Twitter and to Facebook and to emails and all the sort of things that we've become, well, both dependent on and addicted to and the slaves to. So obviously in this walk that you did, you absolutely took the conscious decision to disconnect yourself from social media from this great ogre that we've created. And how was that? How did that feel?
It was much less simple than I thought it would be. So I kind of had this idea that I would disconnect and it would confirm my preconceived ideas about the kind of causes of my anxiety and my stress. I thought that I would emerge from the trail and that I would learn that, yes, social media is bad and I should use it less. And to an extent, that was true. Right. But it also led me to appreciate its good sides all the more, and the kind of the human connections that it facilitates, the fact that without many of these technological tools, I wouldn't be able to make a living the way that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So it did afford that breathing space and that time to consider it intentionally. And for me, that was really important because I think many people don't really approach these matters intentionally because they never really have the time to think about it. I was exactly the same. You know, a new service pops up and it starts being used, and before you know it, everyone's on it, and then you're on it as well, and you've never really had the chance to think about whether you want to give that thing a role in your life. And in many cases, they can take up more room in our lives than we would like if we were given a conscious choice or if we really stopped to think about it. So for me, that's what it was about. It was just being intentional about it. And, you know, to be honest, I probably actually use social media slightly more now than I did before. But I am much more intentional about it. And I have periods where I just don't go online, and I'm able to kind of take it or leave it a bit more easily now. So, yeah, it was very worthwhile. But it was also a somewhat artificial experience because, of course, while there are big areas of signal black spots in the Highlands,
yes,
you also have the opportunity to connect your phone to the web every few days if you wanted to.
Yes.
So it did kind of reinforce the fact that it is very difficult to escape from all this unless you make that conscious choice.
Well, thinking about it, I didn't think about it really, but I suppose I did that in many ways. In that when I was writing, I think it was Bothy Tales, or it might even have been Skydance. I, as you probably know, I went into a bothy that didn't have an internet connection, or any internet connection at all. And once a day, my highlight of the day, or two highlights of the day actually. First one was lighting the fire, and which I have to say was much more important. And the other one was to climb a small hill to get an internet connection.
Yeah.
But it does make you, I think, focus on what it's like to actually be alone, because in many ways, when you've got an internet connection, you're not actually alone. You know, you could pick up the phone and talk to somebody and say, "I'm in the middle of nowhere," you know, and get them to talk to you. Because we're so dependent on all this sort of stuff, right, these days. But one of the things I've noticed is that. I do spend a fair amount of time off grid, and often when I'm communicating with other people who are perhaps, you know, working in the media or all other sort of things, the idea that I'm off grid these days is almost completely alien. People say to me, you know, what do you mean? You only pick up your messages once a day. How on earth can you be there? And it makes you realize how heavily interconnected we all are. And did you feel that disconnecting yourself from the internet as you did highlighted how alone you were, or did it was it an odd feeling in that way?
Well, it's curious really, because I think you are right. You know, finding genuine solitude is very difficult these days, but I think that many of the technologies we use to connect to other people can themselves be quite isolating. So, you know, quite often particularly when we're using social media, our kind of social feeds, they're designed to home in on our individual kind of likes and preferences. And in a way, I think using many of these online tools can be quite isolating. So in taking yourself away from that and going into nature, it can almost perversely be. Yes, it is solitude, of course, but it draws you out of yourself and you become more aware of the kind of non-human communities around you. And it makes you dwell less on your own kind of inner world, or at least that was one effect it had on me. And one byproduct of all that is that it did make me appreciate genuine human connection all the more, because I think, you know, we've got this surfeit of connectivity, but it can be more difficult to find genuine human connections when you can just talk to anyone anytime. Sometimes those connections can feel less valuable until you've gone off grid for a while and until you've had nobody to talk to but yourself.
I think that's a very good point, really, because I think a lot of the connections that we have with people via social media are pretty superficial, really.
Yes, they can be very shallow.
I've got friends on Facebook. I would walk past them in the street. I've no idea who they are. Yeah. Yet they're supposed to be friends. So they're not actually. Yeah, and yet you and I actually met through social media, did we not?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I was talking about when I was starting to write my Mallory play. And I think you said you thought it was a good idea. And I've never been too sure whether you were right, but we certainly did. So one of the things in the book, I think probably, obviously it's not out yet, so I'm not ready, but one of the things that you've talked about, certainly when you've talked to me about the book, is the connection between the natural world that you're walking through and yourself as a human being passing through that environment. And I know that you talked about the cover earlier. I think it'd be quite interesting to talk about that, because I always think I've got particular views about covers. And I always think that it feels quite strange when I've written books in the past. It's not a book until you see the cover. Yes. I don't know if that makes sense to you. Wait a minute. This is not just a load of thoughts that I've poured down into the computer. It's actually going to be a book, a thing that people pick up off the shelf. So what were you trying to achieve? What did you want to achieve through the cover that you designed for the book?
Well, I mean, I had my own personal kind of image of what I imagined the cover to be like. Well before I started writing the book. So the image for the cover came to me pretty much as soon as I kind of experienced the moment itself on the trail. There's this there's an iconic moment on the Cape Wrath Trail, at least there was at that time. On the beach of Sandwood Bay, there was a whale skull. It's been removed now, unfortunately, but there was this whale skull, and you would walk through the dunes and find it, and it would be this moment, or for me anyway, it was this moment of almost mythic wonder in this kind of wild
place.
And as I was standing there looking at the whale skull, I knew that this would be a focal point of the book, that I was going to write about it. I immediately thought, well, this would be a very powerful cover to have this whale skull on it. But at the same time, I knew that it couldn't possibly be the cover, because of course, a cover has to draw in readers of the particular target audience. It has to inform them of genre and theme, and ultimately it has to sell the book. So it was a kind of strange sense of almost dissonance, really, kind of knowing that I already had this firm idea of what I thought, you know, what I would like the cover to be, and knowing that not only would that not be the cover, but that I would be totally okay with whatever the marketing professionals came up with. But ultimately it did inform the process, because, you know, I suggested to Vertebrate Publishing, I think Sandwood Bay would be a good kind of visual theme to go with, because it sits at that kind of intersection between hiking, the outdoors, and also nature, which is where I think the book is as well. You know, it's at that intersection between your kind of classic hiking memoir and new nature writing. So ultimately that's what they went with. That's the brief they sent to the artist. And you've eventually got this image of kind of grey skies over Sandwood Bay with a rucksack and trekking poles on the beach.
Yes, I mean, I think it's an effective cover. I mean, I think that Sandwood Bay is an iconic place, as you say, because I mean, for those of you who've not been there, it's a really remote beach, and it's a great white sweeping arc of sand. And in the distance, there's some really spectacular sea stack. And as soon as I saw the draft of Alex's cover, I could have sort of put you exactly on the map where that was, where the person who painted it was standing, you know. I know exactly where that is straight away. And I think that says a lot to the people who've done, who know that area and who go to that sort of place. I mean, I always think it's a difficult thing about a cover in the sense that, yeah, I'm an author, I'm a writer of sorts. And but I'm not a graphic designer.
Yeah.
And sometimes you've got a concept, and I never know, you know, how much to say, well, I think it should look like this or like that, because I am not a graphic designer. And it's always a bit of a compromise, I guess. But I mean, for, you know, I don't know, there may be people listening who are thinking of producing their own books, and you know, self-publishing is a great way to go. It's the way I got started. And but my one piece of is my piece of sage advice that you get for nothing is that, as I've said, I'm a writer, I am not a graphic designer, and I really do believe that that you should use professional graphic designers to create your cover, because it's a very big temptation these days with the sort of software is about thinking, oh, I can produce this. No, you can't.
Yeah.
And also, I feel, as you know, Alex, you know, you put a massive amount of work and investment of time into anything you write. And to sell it short, okay, it costs you a few quid to get a nicely designed, good cover, but you live with that cover for a long time as a writer. And you pick it up at book shows, and you wave it about, and you have to sign it and all that sort of stuff. And if you don't like it, and if it's no good, you're going to remember that.
And it has to be effective as well. You know, ultimately, it has to sell the book. And I think, I think that's where sometimes, as the authors, we don't always have that objectivity when looking at our own work. That's a very important reason why. Of course, you hire a third-party editor, because you just don't have the objectivity to look at. I mean, I'm a professional editor, and I didn't edit my own book. Of course,
I handed
editors a bursary. It's the same.
Absolutely,
principle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think I've, you know, you've done a fantastic job of editing a lot of my work, and a sort of a heroic job, I think, is probably the best way of describing it. But there have been certainly times when I've been working with you, and I've given you a book, and I said, look, I just can't see this anymore. I'm just so close to it. I don't know really what I've written, whether it's effective and whether it's not. And you do need someone like yourself as a detached professional editor. And often that's the same as you know, working with people who self-published. If you can afford to hire an editor, it makes a big difference.
Oh, definitely.
There's no doubt about it, because you can, you know, people say, oh, well, my auntie Joyce is very good at picking up typos. That's not what editing's about.
No,
what editing's about
typos.
What editing's about is really a different eye looking at a book. It's a bit like when I went on and did a bit of acting, that, you know, somebody else needs to watch you acting because you can't see what you're doing, you know.
Yeah.
So you've done this, obviously, that book's not exactly been put to bed yet, but what date does this book come out?
So it's going to be early September. I believe the date is 2nd of September 2021, and that's the official launch date. It should be pre-order at some point before then, but I don't think we've got an exact pre-order date yet.
Sure. So that's The Father's Shore, and that's coming out, well, just in time for Christmas, really, isn't it?
Yep.
we won't, let's not be too coy about this. That's when it's coming out. So that's brilliant. That sounds a fascinating read, because it is an amazing journey that you took. And I think it's a great thing to have written about. But you said also you've been doing quite a lot of work for, so you're now the editor of Sidetrack magazine, aren't you? What does that role involve you in doing?
Yeah, so essentially at Sidetrack magazine, it's a quarterly adventure journal. it's not quite like the newsstand magazines that you'll be used to seeing in WH Smith and so on. It only comes out a few times a year, and it's kind of it's a lot thicker. It's theoretically there's fewer ads in it, so obviously it is partly ad supported, like all magazines. But we really focus on the kind of the reading experience and the quality of photography and so on. And it's really stories about expeditions, long distance running, cycling and hiking. It's quite a kind of broad church in terms of the adventures it covers. And we've got a small team. John Summerton, he's really the creative drive behind it all. He came up with the whole plan. I mean, he is the creative director, so he's substantially in charge of finding the writers, kind of the overall direction. He also is the graphic designer who puts the whole thing together. And my role is, in addition to assisting John with commissioning new articles, I liaise with the writers, and I basically take ideas through to the finished story. Because not all of our writers are professional writers. Quite often they will be adventurers in the public eye, be people who have done some kind of incredible journey or done some, seen some incredible thing, and they want to write about it, but they have not that much writing experience. Or sometimes they are very good writers, but they just need a bit of a steer to get get something that's in line with the style that we look for. It's a lot of kind of back and forth with writers, bit of rewriting here and there. When I finished with my end of the work, I then pass it on to a sub-editor who kind of gives it the final polish, and then it's off to layout. So we're getting there, just a few days left now on this issue.
Right, that's really quite exciting. Quite a challenge to produce something like that. I mean, what I find, producing this little podcast, which kind of started off as a bit of a hobby, really, during lockdown, is that I've been speaking to some of the foremost climbers and adventurers in the world. Yeah. And compared to them, I'm just a bumbler. but I often find if you're talking to people who appreciate the outdoors, even though they may be at a far higher skill level than you, you can often find a connection in that, because what connects us is our love of the outdoors. Is that something you've found in the work that you've done?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, time and time again, particularly working on sidetrack features, which some of them are the most incredible stories, you see the same kind of motivations and drives. So for example, in one of the features that I've been editing recently, it's really kind of stuck with me. It's an attempted crossing of Spitsbergen in the Arctic, and they faced some of the most extreme conditions imaginable. So this is winter, Arctic winter. Oh, wow. Very little daylight. You've got tents being buried in meters of snow. You've got, deep wind chill, really, really extreme conditions. And of course, because they were trying to save weight, you've got this ongoing calorific deficit. They're not getting enough food. So everything's this massive struggle. But it's all kind of, obviously, there is the motivation to complete the journey. But you also see, appreciation for the beautiful natural surroundings. So just looking up and seeing the aurora. And so absolutely it's you can find a connection, anyone who loves the outdoors, the beauty of nature, coming face to face with a wild creature, observing, a glimpse of the Milky Way through a gap in the cloud. These are definitely the things that connect us. And I think that's why, in particular in Sidetrack, we go for these character-driven stories, because it's the characters themselves and their motivations and why they do these journeys that I think people really respond to.
Yeah, I always, yes, the great story in all the stuff that we write about, whether it's polar exploration or mountaineering or just someone going for a walk in the South Downs, really, is the interaction between people, between a human being and the environment. Yeah. So you've completed a work, another Wanderlust publication, which we're forbidden to talk about, and you've got your The Farthest Shore coming out and Sidetrack magazine. So What's the future for Alex Roddy? Where are you going next? Or did you even know that? I don't know.
Well, I've got a couple of other kind of book ideas simmering away, which I'll probably be working on in due course. For the rest of this year, I'm on the gear reviewing team at TGO magazine, The Great Outdoors. So,
oh right, okay.
Chris Townsend has been gear editor at TGO since 1991, and Judy Armstrong has been women's gear editor for a very long time as well. But this year the team's expanded a bit, so we've also got David Linton and Lucy Wallace and myself.
Oh right, okay, all well known criminal names. Yes, I know who they. I've interviewed on here already. Yes, okay.
So I'm doing GPS. Well, I've already done Backpacking Meals that came out in the May issue. I've got GPS watches, waterproof jackets, and down jackets. So that currently the house is kind of stacked high of kind of gear. GPS watches is the next one. So it's been quite challenging, really. Putting them through the paces, testing out battery life and, accuracy of the sensors and software. So I've got about half a dozen different apps all running on my phone and draining the battery life on it all at once.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're facing the great challenge for all outdoor writers, and that is to be able to produce enough material to live on, whilst at the same time actually trying to have adventures yourself. that very much sounds to me like the quandary that you're in right now. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, it is. It is really, and particularly as COVID threw such a spanner in the works.
I've not
had any hill time. You know, all the gear reviewing that I'm doing, I'm mostly having to do it in Lincolnshire, which luckily I can do with the categories of gear that I chose. But in terms of features, which normally features for TGO and other magazines, which normally comprise a decent percentage of my income, the feature pipeline's basically dried up now because I've pretty much filed all of the trips that I had in the pipeline for features. And until I get the chance to go back to the hills, I'm not going to be able to kind of restart that conveyor belt. And it's definitely the case that once you stop, it is difficult to get going, because normally I would have probably five or six different features in the pipeline at once. You know, one of them would have been handed, one of them I'd be writing it, and there'd be a couple of others kind of commissioned but not yet started upon. But once you stop that, you've got to start from scratch, and you're kind of constantly aware that there are other people out there going and doing the things that you might want to do, and then they're going to be getting the commissions. I mean, I don't like to think of other writers in terms of competition, because we are all on the same side, but kind of my freelancer anxiety can't help thoughts running through my head, you know.
well, I'm sure there's plenty of adventures that you'll be able to find as soon as we're allowed out. And even if the weather cooperates, I'm sure there'll be loads of stuff that you could write in the future. Well, it's been fascinating talking to you. And I'm really looking forward to reading The Father's Shore when it comes out in September. And I wish you all the best with your future editing and your future writing. Alex Roddy, thanks very much for talking to me.
Well, thanks very much, John.